It's On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The newest addition to the science fiction series, The Predator, opens this fall.
Run! Go! Get to the chopper!
The film does not include Arnold Schwarzenegger's cheesy one-liners, but the producers of the 1987 original are back. In this installment, the 6'9" actor wearing the alien mask is played by Georgia native Brian Prince. Brian started out as a student at SCAD in Atlanta, and that's when he learned the gravity-defying stunts of parkour. Videos of Brian's parkour prowess led to his big break in Hollywood. He was stuntman in Black Panther, Captain America, and The Walking Dead, and now he's the Predator. Good morning, Brian.
Morning.
Brian, you practically had to duck coming into the studio.
Yeah.
Do you get sick of jokes about being really tall?
Kind of. So, yeah, I'm like 6'9", 6'9 and a half, technically. And yeah, like every day walking around, people come up to me. I'm like, oh, how tall are you? How's the weather up there?
Play ball.
And it's just funny because my friends at this point get more annoyed than I do because you just kind of, you learn to live with it. You learn to love it a bit.
But first, parkour. Explain that to us a little bit. And how'd you discover it?
Oh, man. Okay, so I started doing parkour back in 2008. So back before American Ninja Warrior was like the big show it is now, it was a lot smaller. And it was originally a Japanese game show, and an American channel first started doing, like they were airing it, and they had a contest for Americans to go over and do it. And in 2008, I was on my first summer vacation from college. So I was like, I'm going to do nothing all summer. I'm going to sit on this couch. And I'm watching Ninja Warrior, and I see these guys just like blasting through the course, and they're parkour athletes. And I was like, what is that? And so I went online, went to YouTube, and I was like, oh, this is that thing from Casino Royale. Oh, I've seen this in commercials. And I was like, I want to try this. So I've always been interested in like jumping and running around like that. But I was the same height I am now at that time. So I was like, no, I can't do that. I can't do that. And after about like 2 days of just looking at videos constantly, I was like, I have to try to do this. And so I went outside and I just started like balancing on stuff and jumping over things. And I've never stopped.
Is Atlanta particularly parkour friendly? I mean, there are a lot of things to jump on.
Oh, there are. Atlanta's pretty good. One of my favorite places to train in Atlanta is Georgia Tech. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good leveling surfaces, walls and rails and things. And yeah, it's a great place to do parkour for sure.
So you were discovered because of videos of your parkour. How did that happen?
Yes. I've been doing parkour now for 10 years. And I started before, like, when the film industry was really just getting started in Georgia. And so there was a lot of crossover. I had, you know, a lot of friends that just did parkour, but then we had some people that were like, we do stunts. And we're like, what is that? And, you know, we would show them parkour stuff. They would show us what they did for stunt work. And so just over time, I had a lot of friends in stunts that either also did parkour, used to do parkour. And it just kind of took one of them being like, hey, you should do this thing. And I was like, all right, put together a resume, you know, bad headshot and submit it. And then that kind of just led to like my first gig.
Wow. So you were in the new Predator movie. This is the fourth in the series.
Yes.
Were you a fan of this franchise before this film?
I was. Admittedly, not the biggest fan. Not that I had anything against it. Like, I always loved the character. But I couldn't say I'm like, oh, you know, I know everything about the Predator. But
I was here when you were mouthing the words that Arnold Schwarzenegger said during that clip.
Yes.
Do you know every word?
Not every word, but I definitely know most of the one-liners in the first movie. When I was in Vancouver while we were filming, they actually, at the Rio Theater, it's like the Plaza Theater here, but in Vancouver, they had a 30th anniversary screening. And so I was off that day, and I was like, I'm going to go watch this. And so I just went to the theater, and I sat in the crowd. And it was really cool because it was a packed theater full of all these diehard fans. And I'm just sitting in the middle, and no one knows that I'm like the new guy in the suit. And it's good to enjoy it.
That's the thing. Yeah. I mean, you're dressed up in the suit. People aren't going to stop you on the street and say, you're the alien.
Yeah.
Unless you wear your costume around.
Exactly. Unless I can make like a really mean face. And then they're like, oh, yeah, that's you.
Well, let's remind listeners of the first Predator film. This was in 1987. The elite military operation team discovers that they're being hunted by something that is non-human.
Billy, you know something. What is it?
I'm scared, Poncho.
Bull. You ain't afraid of no man.
There's something out there waiting for us, and it ain't no man.
So the original Predator was played by the late Kevin Peter Hall. He was 7'2", right? You're 6'9", and did you find this costume uncomfortable?
No, it was great. It was molded for me. But yeah, so it was feel like a glove.
This is Brian Prince, my guest. He plays the alien in the upcoming movie, The Predator. But how long did it take to put this costume on every day?
It actually wasn't that bad. I did a day of Walking Dead, and to put the face zombie mask makeup on took like twice as long as it did just to put the whole entire Predator costume on.
All right, you're leading to a question about, you've been on a lot of film sets.
Yes.
In fact, you were in the Black Panther.
Yes, I was.
So tell me, I mean, this is the biggest grossing movie now of all time. Any good stories from the set?
It was a really cool experience. They did a batch of reshoots in October. And so at that point, the first trailer was already out. And so I remember sitting in the theater. I can't remember what movie we were going to see, but I remember sitting in the theater when I saw that first trailer. And I was like, oh, man, I wish I could have been in that. And so then, you know, I'm back here. I'd recently come back to Atlanta from Vancouver. And I was traveling around all summer. And then I get a call and they're like, oh, can you audition for Black Panther's reshoots tomorrow? And I was like, yes, where do I need to be? And so, you know, I did the audition. They liked it. And so I worked, I think it was about 2 weeks, like 8 days or so, on the big final battle sequence as one of the Jabari warriors. And so, like, I'm in the background fighting.
Well, can you identify yourself? Like, can you see yourself or do you know?
I can't in this one, unfortunately. Yeah. Maybe in, like, the final cut. But everything's happening so fast. And I really couldn't even see myself, especially because we're all dressed kind of the same. But it was really fun because we had about a lot of stunt people out there, and we all practiced all these fight loops. And so we had this choreography that we would try to mix up so it looked like we were doing a lot of original fighting, and it was just a lot of fun. So
every stuntman must have injury stories.
They do. I don't actually. Nothing major. Nothing.
Wow, you're the impenetrable.
Yeah. Well,
stuntman.
We try to be as safe as possible because even though a lot of our job, and you know, once again, I consider myself an amateur at stunts. I know people who've been doing it for 50 years.
You are the Predator.
Yes.
You're an amateur.
I'm still in the beginning of my career. You know, I've only been doing my first stunt job was 2015.
Wow.
And so I'm still just trying to learn as much as possible. One of my favorite things when I am on set is to find or talk to people who have been doing stunts for, you know, decades and be like, you know, what information do you have to offer? Do you have any advice? And they always have so much good advice down to like the smallest things that you never thought you would have needed to keep in mind, you know?
Hmm.
But yeah, as far as injuries go, for stunts and parkour, I'm happy to say I've never had anything more than a bruise, just because I think it's easy to get a little too hyped on things and then kind of throw yourself at something. But I think it's very important to just, you know, take a deep breath before anything happens and then run it all through your head. You know, like whenever we're doing, it's something I learned doing Predator. So when you're on set and they're about to start going, you know, they go, you know, okay, roll sound. You know, the bells go off in the studio. Everyone with a microphone, everyone with the radio is like rolling, and then it gets quiet. And so I always take that moment and I just take a deep breath, and then I let it out. And then by doing that, I try to just clear my head of anything that doesn't need to be there, and I just put myself completely in my character. And I did this for Predator, and I've taken it from that, and I've done it in anything else I've done, just because it just really helps me like settle into who I'm supposed to be for that next 30 seconds, 5 minutes, or whatnot until they call cut. So yeah.
So you've learned a lot from other stuntmen, but in this Predator film, you've got Olivia Munn, Keegan-Michael Key, Sterling K. Brown, some big names. What did you learn from them?
A lot. Keegan's hilarious.
I can only imagine.
He would always just be telling stories, and it's hard to keep a straight face around him, which was my benefit when we were on set. When we were rolling, because I had the big mask on, so I was smiling underneath whenever he was riffing or going through his takes. Olivia Munn is amazing. She's very sweet. She has dogs on set with her all the time, and her dogs are great. Sterling K. Brown, he's a really cool guy. I only met him briefly, but he was really cool. I like talking with him.
Do you have any aspiration to be the leading actor?
You know what? I never did, and now I kind of do because going into Predator, it was, like I said, anything I had done on camera before that was mostly stunt work, and I really enjoy doing stunt work. It's very physical, but I'd never done anything that would consider, you know, more acting heavy, more emotional, more empathetic related instead of action, and so there was a lot of. I shouldn't say a lot because I don't want to say too much, but you know, there are some parts in Predator where I had to be more of a character and less of a less action, more character. Mm-hmm. And I just really found something in those moments. And so since then I've been trying to do more acting. I took a improv acting class at Dad's Garage.
Yeah, I heard
that. I've been looking for more acting classes to do. And it's just, it really surprised me. It wasn't something I didn't expect the spark like that to happen, and it did. And there's just something about it when you really sink yourself into a character and you just become that, and then you watch other people play off of you in their character, and it just helps even more. Like, one of my favorite things about the Predator suit was when I would put on that head and that in the body, and then I'd walk on to set, and people would look at you like, "Whoa, man!" You know, like they don't see me.
Right,
like
you become something else.
It's like I'm a mascot at Disney World, you know. And they're like, "Whoa!" And then I would look what they're doing, I would look what they see, and I would just be like, "Okay, I'm going to give them, you know, 100% of what they're already seeing me as." And it was amazing.
Well, so. I read that they've made an action figure of the Predator, or they're making one.
Yeah, I hope so.
So you can look at that at the toy store or wherever and know that you are that guy.
That'd be cool. Yeah, yeah.
But does it bother you that other people don't know that you were that guy?
No, at all, actually. So I've worked with conventions in Atlanta for like 10 years. I'm a volunteer at Dragon Con. I'm a director at MomoCon. And so we all, me and my friends, we have this like joking idea of being convention famous, right? Where like for the weekend, if you're a voice actor, a voice actress, or a designer or artist, you know, for that weekend, everyone knows who you are and everyone wants an autograph, everyone wants to hang out with you. When you go home, you can go to the grocery store and no one will bother you. And like I said, for me, like, I already have people that come up to me every day and they're just like, "Oh, who do you play basketball for?" And I'm like, "Nobody." And they're like, "Oh, okay." And so I'm kind of cool with none of that. You know, not none of it, but when I don't want it. So I'm kind of cool with not having it.
Yeah, so you get to wear the mask. I mean, all actors wear a mask on some level, but yours is quite literal.
Yeah.
Is there some safety in that?
The head? Yeah, I mean, no, for sure. Like, if anything, so I had a whole team that worked with me. I had a special effects makeup, costuming, and they really were the ones that kind of kept me going every day because, you know, they helped me actually be comfortable and be able to do what I needed to do. But two, like, you know, they were my moral support, and they were great to just have in my dugout with me. And so, yeah, like, they all did their best to make sure everything was, you know, as comfortable as possible.
Well, Brian Prince, what a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. Yeah, you too. This is great.
So glad you're here, and the best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Brian Prince, he is the new Predator. The new film is coming out this fall. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. David Sedaris is a pioneer. 26 years ago, the humorist busted through public radio's polite veneer as a begrudging department store elf in the Santaland Diaries. 10 books later, he is a best-selling author who draws thousands of fans to his public readings. And he dropped by the GPB studios earlier this week before a book signing in Decatur. David Sedaris, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So glad to have you here. Now, among the stories in Calypso, your new book, Family Gatherings at C-Section, your beach house in North Carolina. Where would you be without your family?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I always felt so fortunate to have my family. Even when I was a child, I noticed other people, you know, they would eat dinner and then they would go to their rooms or go watch TV or something. And my dad would leave the table the second he finished eating, and the rest of us would sit around for hours and hours and hours every night. Like in high school, you wouldn't have a boyfriend or girlfriend. You wouldn't not be home, because that was the night I made pizzas and we watched scary movies on TV. You wouldn't not go home for Christmas. But you wouldn't get a driver's license and go out with people in a car. You wouldn't do anything that didn't involve your family. I just always felt so fortunate that way.
Well, your last book, Theft by Finding, this is your diaries and a pretty unvarnished picture of yourself. Apparently you're not very concerned with your self-image, are you?
No. Well, I feel like the worse you admit to being, I think more people can relate to you, actually.
Have you always been like that? I mean, was there a part of you ever that was self-conscious and kind of...
Oh, sure. When I was growing up, I mean, and maybe that has something to do with it. You know, when I'm 61, so I grew up in an era when being gay was the worst thing that could possibly happen to a person. And even if you don't have the word for being gay when you're like 7, you know that you're different from other boys.
I think there's a point in the book when Hugh asks you, why do you choose to focus or remember the negative instead of the positive?
But I don't know. The negative just makes for a better story, I think. Hugh, if Hugh and I are having, and I say, do you remember the time that you emptied that ashtray onto my lap? Why do you have to remember that? We're riding in a car in Normandy, and I put my cigarette out, and the ashtray was on the dashboard, and an ash flew into his eye, and he picked the whole ashtray out of the dashboard and dumped it in my lap. And we're getting ready to board a ferry for England, and I had white pants on, and then he emptied the whole ashtray. I am not going to forget that.
Well, what's your job? Is it stories or is it the truth, do you think?
Well, I mean, they're the same thing in a way.
So remembering the ashtray in the pants is more interesting than the drive to Normandy or drive to the ferry when everything was perfect and the clouds were puffy and lovely in the sky?
That he ruined all that when he emptied the ashtray into my lap. I mean, I would have just written about that, but then he emptied the ashtray into my lap and he ruined it. So it became a story about that.
Does he mind being the subject of your stories?
No, he usually waits and he wants to read the book when it's in galleys, but he knows that I'm not going to write anything about him. Like I've never written what he looks like naked. I've never written, you know, anything that happens with him in the bathroom or anything in the sexually anything about him. So it's all cosmetic, really. I mean I think when I write about Hugh, I'm just kind of writing about making a life with somebody. And so I think anyone in the audience can relate to it. You don't have to be gay. It's just if you're trying to make a life with someone and sustain that relationship, then you can relate to it. I mean, there are other people who would write about it, I think, in a way that you would have to be gay in order to kind of relate in a fundamental way. But we're just not that kind of gay men, you know.
How about your family? It's not that you've written about, you know, what they look like naked necessarily or in the bathroom, but things about them, especially your dad, I guess it comes to me that you spent so much of your life growing up trying to please him, and not that he's in a negative light, but in a real light. And I wonder how he feels reading that.
Well, my dad is the kind of person who has probably the healthiest ego of anyone I've ever met. And so it would never occur to my father that he's ever done anything wrong ever in his life. And so he doesn't mind whatever I say because that's what a person would do. He doesn't, you know, he's of a generation, my dad, where, you know, for instance, he feels entitled to comment on any woman's body anytime, anywhere. You know, he goes into a fast food restaurant and the woman behind the cash register, he thinks that she weighs too much. He's going to tell her. And when you say, Dad, well, someone needs to let her know. So he wouldn't be embarrassed by that. To my dad, somebody would listen to a story about that and say, there's a guy who tells it like it is. We need more people like him.
I'm speaking with the author, humorist, and New Yorker writer David Sedaris. His most recent collection is called Calypso.
I think you also grew up at a time when people didn't talk to their parents about what they observed for their problems. Like in the book, you write about your mom and her alcoholism, and no one in your family called her on it or confronted her about her alcoholism. She eventually died of cancer. But you don't drink, right?
No.
No. Was that, did you see yourself in her or her in you?
Sure. I mean, my mother and I were different kinds of drinkers. I mean, I would drink and then I would write. I mean, I had it in my mind that I could only write when I was drinking, which I don't know how. I guess because I started at around the same time, drinking and writing. And my mother didn't have any kind of an outlet for it. I don't know. It was just really hard. Her drinking seemed an expression of sorrow to me. And that makes me sad thinking about it. You know, when I wrote the essay, I wasn't making any big point. I guess I was just saying that a lot of really good people are alcoholics and they just don't have what it takes. For some reason, they don't have what it takes to quit. I mean, my mother would quit drinking for 4 days and, you know, call me up and say, tell me about it. And then I would call her the next night and, you know, I could tell right away that she was drinking again. She just didn't have the strength to quit. I think, you know, I'm so used to, I'm 61. My mother died when she was 62. And I have moved so many times in my life. And I would move again tomorrow. And 10 years from now, hopefully I would feel free to move again. And, you know, I've learned, or I have a history of changing things for myself, you know? And my mother didn't. And so I think it was unfathomable for her that she could leave my father, that she could quit drinking, that she could start over again. I think 62 felt very, very old to her. And also because she didn't move around much, and she was a very heavy smoker, that, you know, I remember my mom came to visit me in Chicago once, and we were taking the L, and I went up the wrong staircase. And it was a lot of stairs for my mother, and she just barely made it to the top. And then to say, oh, we have to go down, and we have to cross the street, and we have to go upstairs. I felt so bad about it. And I think 62 was old to her in a way that it's not to a healthier person or a sober person.
Yeah, and you almost at that age, are there things that you think of that you can't shake about, you know, dying at her age? Or
I always thought I was going to die when I'm 62. And so I redid my will. And all I'm going to say is a lot of people are going to be really, really happy when I die. It was a lot of fun. It was fun to pick people who would say, who's he? Or people who just wouldn't, they would say, why did he do that? They're going to be really surprised when I die, a lot of people. It's going to be a beautiful day for a lot of people.
We're not looking forward to that day, but that should be a really interesting read in itself. So many people think, because they've read your books, or that they know you, or they've seen you speak, and you're so forthcoming, you're so fluid, it seems to me, when you're speaking. Do you think they know you?
Yeah, but that's okay with me. You know, that's why when I meet people, like at a book signing, and it's true, it's just sort of lopsided, that they know a lot about me, and I don't know anything about them. So I was with an author not long ago. We were being interviewed together. And she said, when people come up to get a book signed, she said, if I don't say anything, I learn how they got there. Because they'll say, oh, I read something of yours in a magazine, and then I bought your first book. I would never do that. I would never do that. The fact that they're there is enough for me. And I feel like I need to learn something about them, because to try to even that unbalance a bit. So when somebody comes to get a book signed from me, I just start asking them questions immediately. Someone tried to hashtag me to me
really?
A little while ago, because she came to get a book signed. And let's say her name was Meredith. I said, Meredith, have you ever had sex for money? But I just thought that was a funny question to ask somebody at a book signing. I just think that that's funny, you know? So, and I do enjoy, like, I love signing books, and I love, because it's, I'm talking to people and meeting them in a way that most people will never get a chance to. You can't go to a hotel and go up and ask the desk clerk anything you want. You can't, you know, a driver, you know, I never learned to drive a car, so often when I go places, there'll be a driver to take me. You're locked up in a space with somebody, so there's a lot of things you can't. I mean, it'd just be weird because you're in an enclosed area together. But if people came specifically to see you and to stand in line to talk to you for 2 minutes, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful little relationship, especially when they know enough about you. So it just really is all about them. I mean, I met a woman a couple of weeks ago, and both her father and her brother are in prison for child pornography. Mm. And she didn't come up and tell me that. I asked a question and then asked another question, and then there was that. I met a guy, and I said, what do you do? And he said, I'm kind of trying to figure that out. I said, you should be an outlaw. You look just like one. And he said, I just got out of prison for 2 years for reckless endangerment and selling drugs. So that was fantastic, to talk to him a little bit more about that. So sometimes people come up and they have a story they want to tell you, but that's usually not the story that is, there's something more interesting behind it. I remember years ago, I was at the Aspen Comedy Festival. We did a play there, and I saw Spalding Gray do something called Interview the Audience. And he brought three people up on stage, and he asked them questions. And I thought, okay, well, that was fake. That was all prearranged. It wasn't. He was just so good at asking people questions and at making them comfortable.
That would be a great book, or a great host, I guess. Conversation Starters with David Sedaris. Like, have you ever had sex for money?
Well, you know, but when you think about that as a book, if you thought, well, if the book was edited, then it wouldn't count in a way, because he wasn't editing those. The people were live in front of the audience, and so it would sort of ruin the trick in a way. You know, if you said, okay, I'm going to talk to 25 people and then publish it afterwards, it would have to be unedited. But he could have done that. But I think he's probably one of the few people I've ever known who could do that. Unedited conversations with people just based on the questions that he came up with. He pulled them right out of the audience. Mm. But I feel like sometimes somebody will come up to get a book signed and I don't like the person, usually because they're being too controlling, right? And they want you to do this and do a certain way and draw a picture of this. But I don't want them to go away until I like them.
So you make it your work to like them?
Yeah. I think, okay, I don't like this person right now, but I don't want to leave it on this. I don't want to leave on this note.
So what would you say to them?
Gosh, it would really kind of depend on the person. But hopefully I could find some way to get them off that track and ask them a question that would disarm them. And then we could just completely get on another. Like, I need to let them know. This woman came up, and she was, I don't know, she got on her knees, right? And I eat dinner while I sign books. So she got on her knees in front of the table, and I think she'd been drinking. And I wrote in her book, "You breathed on my chicken." I don't want that on my book. I said, well, that's what you got. I said, because you breathed on my chicken. I need to write, "You're a breath of fresh air." And I said, you're not. You're not a breath of fresh air. You're just kind of annoying and you breathe on my chin. But then I tried to put us on a different track because I didn't want to end it that way. because I want to like the people who like me. I mean, I realized that a long time ago. It's a good policy to like people who like you. Because generally speaking, like writers say, right, the writers I love would all hate me if they ever met me.
Why do you think?
I don't know. I don't know if I just like people who wouldn't like me. Or, I mean, a lot of them were just, you know, like people like Richard Yates. He didn't like anybody, really.
Well, David Sedaris, what a pleasure to speaking with you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Author David Sedaris, his latest book, Calypso, is out now.
It's been a long week, and we've talked about Brazilian barbecue, identity politics, and Mean Girls on Broadway. So as we do every Friday, we've gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and discuss some of the top stories that everybody is talking about. It's time for The Break Room.
You can't just stand on the front porch staring at your Muslim neighbors.
So I think that I appreciate Starbucks getting in the fight on this. That matters, but it's really just a beginning.
And Morgan Freeman's legal team has sent CNN a 10-page letter essentially saying, take it back and say you're sorry.
And joining us in the break room are Atlanta-based LGBT educator and activist Robbie Medved, Atlanta attorney John Bush, and journalist and former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
All right, let's start with the story that kept evolving throughout the week. Roseanne Barr now blames Ambien for the racist tweet that got her hit show dropped from ABC. Her co-stars, several of them, including Wanda Sykes, said they would no longer work for the show. ABC pulled the plug on the sitcom. And the actor and comedian Tom Arnold, he was a writer on the original Roseanne series, also Roseanne's ex-husband. Here he is talking with CNN's Anderson Cooper.
I can see it coming because she, you know, has a lot of, by the way, this monkey thing is something she's tweeted before about black people. Why is it okay? It's a meme that she and thousands of her alt-right fans do. They love calling black people monkeys. It's not a one-time joke, okay?
Anyone buy Roseanne's apologies?
Not in the slightest. I've taken Ambien plenty of times, and it's only made me friendly and sleepy.
Well,
that's it.
As the manufacturers of Ambien did tweet, that racism is not part of the side effects.
Exactly. And if you look at anything that Roseanne has done in the past 4 or 5 years, her tweets and her statements have been disgusting. It's been transphobic. It's been racist. It's been Islamophobic. All kinds of stuff. Like, I'm not sure why anyone was surprised by this.
Well, Roseanne's defenders, using the I Stand With Roseanne hashtag, demanded the firings of Joy Behar and Bill Maher, also network stars who they accuse of racism. Is this going to be heard, John, do you think, as the dog whistle to those who resent the liberal PC-obsessed media, as it said?
Nobody is seriously defending what Roseanne said, but a lot of people are offended that there's a double standard that when conservatives cross... Well, Roseanne's not even a conservative. She ran as a Green Party candidate several years ago. But we have Keith Olbermann was promoted over the weekend. We have the horrible things that Samantha Bee said about Ivanka Trump. And there's really no punishment for that.
But there's nothing relating what Samantha Bee said to what Roseanne said.
No,
Samantha Bee used,
right.
She was vulgar, but it wasn't racist.
I don't think what Samantha Bee said was correct. And she should have said it, but it wasn't the same as what Roseanne Barr said.
She was vulgar and she advocated incest with her father.
Well, in fairness, Donald Trump has advocated incest with his daughter.
Okay, well, we should point out that the focus of Roseanne's racist comments were a black woman, and the announcement that she was fired was made by a black woman. I'm just trying to imagine the decision-making process for her.
I don't think they had a choice. I think that ABC, if they wanted to keep their sort of general audience, I'm not talking, I mean, and I don't know who Roseanne's audience was. I didn't watch the show. but it was so clear case that they had to cancel the show. And I actually think that they knew that something like this might happen. I mean, everybody said at the beginning, she's not stable. She's hard to work with. So it's not a surprise, I don't think, that it might have ended this way.
Well, I want to pick up on John's comment, though. It's not the first time we've seen racism in tweets from people with significant Twitter following. So, you know, what is a fireable offense? Is racism crossing a different line than others?
Roseanne's tweet was abhorrent. Nobody serious is out there defending it. But at the same time, too, I don't think any of us want to live in a world where we take offense and we immediately advocate somebody be taken off the air. It's absolutely fine that Disney took her off the air. But if we're going to draw that line, there are a lot of other lines. There are a lot of other people who probably need to be coming off the air, too.
Well, what are the bright lines here? Where are we seeing them?
I think when you start advocating that a group of people is not equal to another group of people simply based on who they are, that's when you really start to cross the line.
Okay, so you're talking about people in the aggregate rather than an individual person like Melania Trump, for example.
For the most part, yeah.
So is this a pattern, though? Tweet now, apologize later?
But I think people need to be responsible for their tweets, and they need to realize that we are in a different time. You can't just that, well, you can say whatever you want, but that there are repercussions.
Well, if you're the president, you can say whatever you want, and there really aren't repercussions, well, which I think
that's
been filtering
a double
down.
Standard.
Absolutely.
Know?
I think that kind of attitude has been filtering down.
The Atlanta-based Laugh Network dropped the original run of Roseanne from its schedule. Several other networks have done the same. And this is a challenge, you know, for people who are Cosby fans or lovers of Woody Allen films. Do we have to hate on the old Roseanne, too?
I have a really hard time, me as Robbie, I have a really hard time separating the art from the artist in so many ways. Knowing that even though at that time it might not have been the same, my money or my advertising dollars or whatever it is still going to fund them, and they're still getting reciprocals and still getting all that stuff. I just don't want my money going to that kind of thing.
Okay, so let's get to advertising dollars here. About 8,000 Starbucks stores closed their doors for 4 hours on Tuesday. This was for racial bias training. The company announced this after two black men were arrested at a store in Philly while waiting for a friend. Now, employees at this training watch videos featuring Starbucks executives and Common, the musician and activist, running employees through scenarios that could elicit a biased reaction. So, all better now?
Yeah. I think this is a first step. You know, I think that everybody sees that. And there were, you know, according to the reports, a lot of people were uncomfortable in those seminars, which makes you realize that there's a lot of work to be done still.
Yeah, I think anybody who thinks that this is going to be the end all be all is severely mistaken. And I don't know that this is a problem that they can fix through sessions.
I want, a 4-hour seminar.
Right. This is something that's ingrained in our society that, as a society, we have to reckon with. And I don't think we're prepared to do that just yet.
Well, there is also some criticism that anti-bias training isn't enough, that there is more systemic education that needs to happen.
Without a doubt. And I think that's where everything comes into play between schools and the police force and so many other factors that I think, as a society, we just are afraid to deal with at this point. There are too many people who think that this type of talk becomes oppression or even the fake concept of reverse racism or that kind of stuff.
Well, materials from the training are being made available to the public. Should other companies conduct similar trainings, John? What do you think?
They already are. It's pretty standard in corporate America at this point to have training like this. The effectiveness is unclear.
Well, how about Starbucks' response? Is it laudable or is this a PR stunt?
I'm worried it's a PR stunt. I'm really hopeful that there's going to be some good stuff coming from this. But I know that it only affected the stores that were actually owned by Starbucks, so I heard about plenty of stores that were still open. So at some point, you know, there's only so much they're going to be able to do.
The company did lose an estimated $12 million during the closure. And this was also a boon for other businesses. Apparently, black-owned coffee shops promoted it, opened their doors. So is anyone reconsidering a grande latte macchiato with caramel?
Well, Starbucks is fundamentally is seen as a liberal institution. It's seen as something that more liberal patrons go to. And they had a PR issue with respect to their liberal patrons. They have responded to it the best that they can from a corporate standpoint.
I have to disagree. I don't believe it's a liberal institution. I think everybody goes to Starbucks or stops by or whatever. So I think, but I do think they had a PR problem. I don't think that this is the end of it.
Nobody sees them as right-leaning.
Let's move on to the next story. Valedictorian at Holy Cross Catholic High School, this is in Kentucky, his commencement speech was banned by the school for being too political. So Christian Bales delivered it using a bullhorn.
Class of 2018, we are dynamic and we are intelligent. We have a voice and we're capable of using it in all communities. We've learned a multitude of things at Holy Cross, and for that we extend a sincere thanks to our teachers, parents, faculty, and peers. However, it does not stop here.
Okay, apologies for the sound on the bullhorn, but Bales is gay, describes himself as gender nonconforming. His mom said the principal asked for her help in making sure her son arrived at the graduation ceremony in, quote, appropriate male dress. So can we agree here? The school did not accomplish its goal.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, I really have nothing nice to say about this school whatsoever. I've read his speech. I thought it was fantastic. It really was talking about the power of teens and kids in the next generation to make a statement and speak up. And he even thanked the school for teaching him those skills.
There was nothing political about it. I mean, I read the speech also. I went to Catholic schools growing up, so I just, this makes me very sad that this would happen. And that, you know, one of his lines was, young people must be willing to speak candidly about issues and mustn't tremble in the face of institutions that try to silence us. And he did say it on the bullhorn, but it's just sad that that's what this school chose to do.
Well, Robbie, you brought up the point that this is a new generation of kids. They have access to another kind of bullhorn on Twitter. So should schools be considering things differently? Should they make different rules or lean back on rules because kids have this access?
Educators never respond to PR situations well. I mean, going back to when we were in high school, you censored a newspaper, you do something else. There is just not what they respond well to. And you're dealing with teenagers who push back very quickly.
Yeah, and with his speech, you know, he wasn't actually getting political. I think that this was really a case of a Catholic school not wanting an openly gay kid to talk about the fact that he was openly gay.
Right, so they were trying to get out ahead of it.
Absolutely.
If you're just joining us, we're hanging out in the break room. With us is Atlanta-based LGBT educator and activist Robbie Medved. Just heard from him, Atlanta attorney John Bush, and the journalist Kathy Lohr. All right, on to actor Morgan Freeman. His attorney demanded CNN retract a story accusing the actor of sexual misconduct. And last week, the network posted an article accusing him of that behavior. And the article's co-author and sole accuser alleges he made offensive comments when she interviewed him. This was during a press junket for the movie Going in Style. He's denied it, but admitted to making some people feel uncomfortable throughout his career. Now, first of all, is this a flashback moment? Are you shocked to hear Morgan Freeman? Is he unimpeachable?
The problem is no one's unimpeachable. I think there's so many of us, especially men in power, who don't even realize the power of what they think is a benign statement and the way that it comes across. And sure, it might not have been full-on assault, but if he said something that made someone else uncomfortable because of her gender or what she was wearing, that's a problem. That's a major problem.
Freeman has been caught on camera making questionable remarks, and they've been shown, you know, in the past week or two, about dresses that reporters wear and, you know, would you be willing to fool around with an older man and those kind of things, which are just completely inappropriate. He's 80 years old, and I think men, actors, CEOs, people have to realize that they need to stop this behavior. And clearly he did it while the cameras were running before the actual official interview began, but he was on camera doing this stuff, and it's sad. Again, another sad story.
CNN's lawyers have been defiant. What do you think? Should the story be retracted while pending investigation?
No. I mean, that's not how journalism works. I mean, there isn't a burden on journalists to have legal protection, to have legal sources for everything. They've got their sources. They often have anonymous sources that they've checked out, and we trust them as journalists to do the research. But, you know, when you get, you know, actual research, when you get a legal threat, that's pretty common, I would say, that, you know, people don't like negative stories about them. But
I have a problem with anonymous sources, and you probably do,
right?
Too. Because as a reporter, we did not use them. We had to have two sources to independently verify facts before we would report something.
Sure, but so, once you got those sources and you faced a legal challenge at that point, you wouldn't really back down if you were confident in your information.
Well, no. CNN has interviewed 16 women who brought similar charges or said similar things. But on to legal problems for Melissa McCarthy, a new Georgia resident. She faces a lawsuit from Sesame Street. Now, this lawsuit claims that her upcoming R-rated film, we should say, The Happy Time Murders, alleges in effect that these depictions of Muppets, pseudo Muppets, I should say, having sex, using drugs, graphic language harms the child-friendly reputation of its signature puppet. We couldn't even play the trailer to tell you the truth. So, are you ready to see these pseudo Muppets use profane language?
It's not what I'm jumping to see, but certainly understand where Sesame Street was coming from and filing suit. They lost their TRO. But the lawsuit remains pending. It seems like the ship sailed with raunchy puppets back when we had Team America in the early 2000s.
And
the judge did rule that they could continue using the tagline "No Sesame, All Street" in promoting the film. So I don't know. To me, it's a raunchy comedy. It's not meant for kids. I'm not against it, but I don't know if I'm going to see it.
Definitely. Like I saw the trailer and I saw the tagline, and it made me stop and think for a second when I saw just a print ad about it. And I did in my mind make the association. But then I think back to a few years ago when Avenue Q, the musical, came out. And that's an incredibly raunchy puppet show that's blatantly a takeoff on Sesame Street. And the same arguments happened then. And Sesame Street did not lose their wholesome image by any means with that. And if you've ever seen it, it's got some graphic puppet stuff going on.
Well, Melissa McCarthy's last movie did not do particularly well. Some saying, you know, she's pushing the raunch a little too far. Has she jumped the shark?
Not at all. I think people are uncomfortable seeing women push that kind of stuff that men have been pushing for so long. But I would say, no, I'd bring it on. If she's happy making her movies and she's financially stable doing them, good for her.
All right, we got to wrap super quickly. But Solo, the new Star Wars film, released this past week. Some mediocre reviews, but the co-writer Jonathan Kasdan confirmed that Lando, played by the actor of the moment, Donald Glover, is pansexual. Did anyone get that seeing the film?
Look, we've seen this over and over with Harry Potter and Dumbledore. If he's not in the original writing and it's not talked about, it's not real. You know, everything else is just fan fiction. I would love it if there was a queer character on Star Wars and everywhere. But unless you're going to make it real, it doesn't count.
Well, if he is pansexual, then the question is, how is he going to be portrayed in future movies? Because apparently, I haven't seen the movie, but it wasn't clear, as you said.
We already know that he wears a lot of capes.
Is that it? I mean,
well, then bring on Superman.
Well, so that's the question.
There you go.
All right, so quickly, did Lucasfilm franchise finally deliver on a not clearly heterosexual character, or is this just queer baiting? What do you think, John?
We have come a long way where we're talking about this instead of Overkill. Overkill, it's only 3 years ago, and we're debating this. I mean, that shows you how far the gay rights movement has come.
Well, he's shaking his head. We are out of time in the break room, and thank you to all my guests, Atlanta-based educator and activist Robbie Medved.
Thank you very much.
Atlanta attorney John Bush and Kathy Lohr.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you. Break time is over, and so are we.